Okay, let's get started. So,
would you use that or this?
Okay, I don't speak Swedish, but. Thank you. I would like to show you. We were talking about Windows systems. This is something that was done in the group by Olivier Chapuis and Nicolas Roussel. And what we wanted to do was to experiment with different things you could do with Windows. So this is a Windows system where you can move Windows in 3D. And it's not just to do 3D for the sake of it. It's just because if you have two windows that are a bit too big, if you move them in 3D, they can look almost the same and use less space. Now, the way this works is, in fact, the image of the window is mapped in 3D. So as you saw, the menus and things like this work as you'd expect, which a number of other things like Compiz and others didn't do at the time, but they've copied what we did since then. We experimented with various ways of resizing windows. Sometimes you want to just distort the window, like we're doing here. Sometimes you want to resize it with rearranging the content. And I'm going to skip through some of this. And sometimes you want to scale windows. The window to the left, in fact, was given a different size and then scaled down. So this is what I wanted to do. So we've done things like, have you ever wanted to look what's behind the window? Well, the way we do this is by curling the window. And that works. Now here we are rearranging. So what we did is we took an X window server and we did weird things to it. So the advantage of this is regular applications. We did not have to change any application. At some point, this system was distributed as part of the Mandriva Linux distribution. Unfortunately, I think the Mandriva didn't do so well. It was widely distributed in Brazil, in particular, because Mandriva was big in Brazil. This is a thing where you see the overview of 9 virtual screens, and you can manipulate the windows. The windows are live, you see the video playing. And so you can organize your virtual space by having this sort of zooming out to see all your space. It could be 3x3, 4x4, whatever. And then you can interact with each of these windows if you want to. You can scale them to gigantic sizes. And in fact, the latest thing we've done with this is, in our lab, we have this large wall display where we have 30-inch screens side by side to create a wall approximately this size, and we can run the window system on this wall. This was an application to tabletop. So imagine this is on the table. As you move the window, it rotates to face the person on one side or the other side of the table. I can also take an existing window. We'll see this in a second. So selection, all this works. Again, the application knows nothing about what's going on. Here, what I'm doing is that instead of just rotating the window, I'm making a clone. Again, I'm not creating a new window from the perspective of the application. I have two copies of the windows, of the window, and it works in such a way that if two people interact together, they don't step on each other's toes. Now, we've done something even more radical, and that's called facades. And so here, what we're doing, so this is what's called the Photoshop for Linux. GIMP, thank you. This is the GIMP. Unmodified GIMP. And so what we're doing here is that we are creating our own palettes out of the GIMP palette. This is a feature of the window manager. It's not a feature of the application. Why does this work? Well, because in the X Window system you have a window tree. So these widgets, in fact, if you explore them from the window system's perspective, they are sub-windows, so you have access to them. So the type of things I was doing at the whole window level before, I can do at the level of these sub-windows. So I can take one and make a copy of it and assemble it in a different way. From the application perspective, when it draws into that window, it will in fact draw into the two copies, and the same thing when you interact. If I interact with a copy, the application will think that you're interacting with the original. So that means that we can customize the application to create our own tool palette. And here it shows that, you know, it works in the same way. I'm going to fast forward. I hadn't planned to show you this today, so. So here is an example where I'm adding the tools inside the work area itself. So I put here, I think it's the tool to create rectangles, the tools for the selection tool, the drawing tool, the eraser is still up there. Okay. Now, the next thing I'm going to do here is creating a tool glass. So, I've created yet another tool palette here, and I turn it on. This is to show that we can save these things and they get recreated when you restart, so it's not so interesting. Okay, so here I've created this palette again with colors and a few tools. And what I'm going to do is to turn it. No. Okay, well, we can do widget replacements. I'll skip this part. You can watch it online. Yeah, here it is. So we call these facades. So I'm creating again this facade here, which I copied from other tools. And I turn it into a tool glass. So I move it with the left hand now. And as you see, I have my regular cursor. And now what happens is when I click, I do this click through. And you probably think, but how come this works? Again, this is unmodified GIMP. And the way it works is that when I click in the tool glass, what the system does is it does one click in the tool and then one click in the surface underneath. So when I started creating the rectangle here, even though I did one click, there was one click sent to the tool, selecting the tool, and then one click on the surface to start creating the rectangle itself. Same thing for creating the circle here, same thing for starting the color, the pen tool, same thing for selecting a color.
Was it like an event propagation?
It's not exactly that.
Okay.
Because first of all, because it's outside the application, not inside. And in fact, we're not just propagating, we're forking the event. One event, one user event gives rise to two events. Okay, here's another example where we took, again, the GIMP when you have the image navigator. And you remember OrthoZoom from yesterday? Well, what we did is that we said, if I find an application that has a scroll bar. Now we use something called the accessibility API. So if you are a good developer, you make your applications accessible, and that means that you make it so a number of technologies for disabled people can take advantage of your application. And for this, you expose some features of your application, like the menu structure and things like this. So if we find something that is a scroll bar, and we also find the function for zooming, well, we turn the scroll bar into an OrthoZoom scroll bar. And so here you see as I move up, I zoom out. Now, in the original GIMP, you would have to do the scrolling and the zooming separately. But here, we've integrated into the scroll bar, and we just trigger the commands inside the GIMP, and we get OrthoZoom without programming the application. Yeah, well, I think that's more. So the idea in this work is that we wanted to experiment with new ways of letting people customize their applications. And we wanted to show that this is something you can do from inside the application, as it's done today, but it may be more interesting to let people do it from outside the application, so you're not you're not constrained by the decisions that the designers have made about what is and is not customizable. Anyway, so that was sort of an aside about Windows systems and the kind of things you could do if you had more powerful Windows systems and more open applications, in a sense. A lot of the things rely on the fact that you can inspect the features of an application from the outside. And I think one big problem we have today is in the way interactive software design is it's very closed. It's very closed. So, you know, when you open an application, you enter the world of that application, and you're stuck in there. And you have a few things like drag and drop and copy paste, but that's basically it. If we open things more, we could do a lot more. So back to toolkits we were on Windows systems, so now I'm going one level up in my stack there. I'm doing the user interface toolkits. And that's the sort of major access point for creating applications. You know, I would say probably 95-99% of applications today are created using a user interface toolkit. They also use the Windows system, the graphic level, but that's the main entry point. And so user interface toolkits were created, as I said, when the vocabulary for graphical interaction started to standardize, and then we identified things like buttons and the menus and the scroll bars and the dialog boxes. And in good software engineering practice, the idea was to package those into software modules and into abstractions. So the abstraction was called the widget. And widget, the word widget is a play on the window object. But the widget is also a word that says, you know, a thing. And so a widget is an interactive object that has three facets. There's first, what does it look like? Second, how does it behave in response to user events? What happens when I click and do things to it? And third, how does it communicate with the rest of the application? How does it let the rest of the application know that I've clicked the button, I've moved the scroll bar, and things like this? So to create an interface, you create a tree of widgets. You have some widgets like these that are sort of, well, menu items are sort of the leaves of the tree. But to assemble widgets together, you put them into containers. So a menu is a container that knows that its component widgets have to be sort of stacked vertically and things like this. A dialog box is another type of container where you have to specify the layout. But maybe it will automatically give you buttons to the bottom right and things like this. So you create a widget tree that describes the content of each of your windows. So some container widgets will do the layout automatically. Most of the time, you will have to provide more information to say, well, here is where I want things to go. Typically, a widget is going to be inside its parent in the tree. This is not an absolute rule. Typically, if you have a pop-up menu, it is conceptually under the menu bar item or the item that triggers the contextual menu, but you don't want it to be displayed on the inside of it. So this enclosure rule is not always true. And then different containers have different ways of laying out their content. Some will ask you to specify constraints, like I've shown here. We'll see a demo in a moment. Others have other ways to organize things, for example, according to a certain grid. If you've programmed in Swing, you've learned to hate the, what is called, the read bag layout, which is really, really terrible to use. And layout in general is complicated. Why is it complicated? Because what you're trying to do is to specify in a declarative way a behavior that is dynamic. Because it's not just about saying this button is here, this button is there, and this field is there. It's also saying what happens when I get this bigger. What happens when I localize my thing in a different language and the word file is twice as long? So you have to describe in a way that is declarative a whole collection of different layouts and how they behave when the size of objects that are involved changes. Yeah, so this is so here by laying out things like this and saying I want OK to be attached to the left, to the right border and to the bottom, and the cancel to be attached to the OK button, and these to be attached instead to the top, and the field is attached both to the left and to the right, but doesn't have a constrained width. It means that if I enlarge things, the buttons are going to stick to the bottom right, this is going to stick to the top, and the field is going to expand as needed. So as I said, there are three facets. The presentation says what it looks like. It's typically configurable. I want to be able to change the color of things. I want to be able to change the label in the button. I want to be able to change a number of graphical attributes. The behavior typically is not configurable or not very much, because it is really the behavior that makes the widget what it is. Something is a button, not because it looks like a button, but because it behaves like a button. Now, it's good practice to also make it look like a button, otherwise the user may not realize that it's that you can click on it. But what really makes it a button is that when you click on it, something happens. And the something that happens is both that the presentation may be affected. If you drag the thumb on the scroll bar, of course, you want the thumb to move. If I type into a text field, I want the text to appear. But more importantly, at least as importantly, it needs to also notify the rest of the application of what it's doing. And that's where things get hairy. Because the way it works, and because of this model that I described before, where events get dispatched, they go to, in the case of a token, they go eventually to a widget, and the widget has sort of the behavior code that runs on this event, and then the behavior code is going to say, oh, I need to tell the rest of the application that something interesting is happening. And that's where you get the listeners, the callbacks, the handlers, the whatever you call them. And the idea is that you attach to an object a function that will be called later, at some later point in time, when something interesting happens to that object. So I have an OK button in a print dialog. Well, I need to attach to this button a callback. When I create the button the first time, I need to attach a callback that says, well, call the function doSay whenever you get clicked. Now the problem is this spaghetti of callback that I was talking about before. Because all these functions are sort of little islands in your code. They get called from nowhere. I mean, they call from somewhere, but as a programmer, you don't care where it comes from. You know, at some point, it's going to be called. And typically, they need to share state. The OK button to print needs at least to know which file you're saving or printing or whatever the example is. And so, the function that is, the callback that is attached to the field here, the file to print or to save, this is going to be called when you edit things here. And you may click the OK button, you know, the next day. So when you call this, it needs to have a way to know what was in there. So either this function would have saved it in some global state, or the OK button has a way to know that, well, I should ask this widget that is, quote, next to me on the screen, but in the structure, it's somewhere else in the tree. I could ask that state. It means that the next time you're going to change your mind and change the structure of your dialog box, your code is going to break. And the problem of this is your code becomes very brittle. It can break very easily. It's also difficult to test, because the only way to test is to have someone clicking randomly everywhere, because of course you always test the normal cases where people do things right. But things break, of course, when unusual things happen. So, you know, put a six-year-old in front of the thing and ask him to... and it's very hard to automate testing of interactive systems, unlike non-interactive systems. And so, it seems like everything is really against us. We don't have the right language, programming language constructs and abstractions. We don't have the right way... We don't have easy ways of testing things systematically. And we have this spaghetti of callbacks code that makes it very difficult for someone who has not created the code to understand what's going on. Because things are related, are closely related, that can be very far away in the code. And if you ever looked at someone else's program in Swing or something, it takes a lot of work to understand what's going on. Even though when you use the application, it's pretty simple and obvious what's going on. So this discrepancy between what you see on the screen and what you do on the screen and the way it's described in the code is really a source of problems. Now, there have been ways to improve this. So for widgets that represent a state, like here a slider, instead of having a slider where you set a callback every time the user changes the slider, you can do something which is not unlike what we saw in Brad Victor's demo, that establishes the link between the state and the state in your program that is a variable. So that when I change the slider, the variable changes. But also, if in my program I change this variable, then the visual state changes. So you establish this link, and then in your mental model of your program, this variable equals this widget. In fact, it could equal several widgets. You could imagine having not only a slider, but also a textual value. And that's where things get interesting, because if I have a text field to enter a value that is also linked to this variable, whenever I change this, it would propagate to here, which would propagate back to the text field, which would change the state automatically. And all you had to do was to establish these two links instead of creating half a dozen callbacks and take into account everything that can happen. Now, this works quite well for simple data types, and there may be some, you know, it may be hard to implement if you don't have the right framework. For more complex data types, like a table or list or things like this, there are systems that also use active values. But in general, it's more the MVC model that we'll talk about in another class. And it's still very hard to maintain this consistency between what's in your program and what's on the screen. And this is what interactive programs do most of the time. So, you know, we should have better ways of programming these things again.
Active values.
Sometimes it's called active variables, actually.
Another word is binding, they use in a lot.
Well, so in the Xcode environment, it's called binding. In some other environments, it's called binding. In the Tickle TK, it's called active value.
In another flex, I think it's binding also.
Binding. Okay, well, let's call it binding.
I
knew it was a binding in Xcode. I didn't know in other environments.
Would it be easier from the code to remember? I mean, the links, or it would be easier to have a visual feedback, like to connect things, and then like.
Yes, and that we'll get to it.
Okay.
You're way ahead. Now we'll get to it, but yes. So this is a variation on the callback where it's a little bit more structured. It's closer to what you get with listeners in Java because it's done in object environments. So this is not exactly what you have in Java, but the idea is to attach a visual object not to a callback function, but to an object in your program, and make it so that for some actions you do on the object here, some methods are called on your object in your program. So the listeners, well, it's a little bit like that. It's not exactly, but it's a little bit like that. The advantage is that with that you can have more local localization of your code. So it's still, instead of big mess of spaghetti, it's small clumps of spaghetti. It's a little bit better. Okay, so there's a zillion toolkits. They're all bad. No, really, really. I spent for many years, I was using TCL, which I like because it had these active values, including for things like lists, which I hated because I don't like the language. So, you know, when you get something right, they get the other side wrong. So, but it is a little bit hard to program interfaces even today. The interaction is limited to what's happening inside the widget. And for such a basic interaction like drag and drop, it's not covered by these toolkits. Have you tried to program drag and drop in Java? No, no, you can. It's based on it's at the event level. It's not at the level of widget. Because it's not a widget. Drag and drop is not a widget. A widget by definition is something that's is on the screen, and as long as you interact inside of it, yes, it works. Something like drag and drop, even copy paste, even undo, they're outside the widget model. And so what happens is that they're typically covered in application frameworks.
Could the drag and drop be it's a behavior and you can like use it as a widget to attach it, like.
Aha, but if you separate the behavior from the, say, visual aspect of the widget, yeah, that may be interesting because I could attach behaviors to various things. Yeah. But when you program with widgets, no, you don't get the behavior without the widget or the widget without the behavior. They're clumped together. So originally, applications frameworks were really skeletons of code, so incomplete code where you had to fill in the blanks for your application. Now, of course, very quickly this evolved to be more flexible. The first framework is MACAP, and in fact, a lot of the frameworks that you have today are, well, technically they are frameworks that are different from a widget toolkit. In practice, things tend to be sort of bundled together, so it's not always easy to see what's part of the framework and what's part of the widget toolkit itself. But MACAP introduced things like the concept of the document, the fact that the window could be linked to a document, if you build the framework for this, it means that a lot of things are going to be taken care of for you. Remembering whether the document was saved when you close the window, doing this old save dialog box, doing recording a history of events so you can undo and redo things, all these things. So the concept of action, for example, is powerful because if you capture what not just the user is doing in terms of input events, but the effects of those events, saying, well, this file has been moved to the trash, or this object has been changed color, or this database record was changed, you capture this into an object called an action, and that action you can store in your program. You can even imagine storing it on disk, and that gives you a history of action. If for each action you provide not only the execute operation, but the do operation, but also the undo, you can have undo and things like this. So in many of these frameworks today, you have these higher level concepts for managing things like the cat copy paste type of interaction, the drag and drop interaction, as I said, history, some standard patterns as well for editing things, etc., etc. So it makes life easier, but it also shows that a number of things that are done in there should be done, in my opinion, should be dealt with more elegantly by some lower level in the stack. The thing I'm going to try to do now is something risky. I'm going to give you a little demo of Interface Builder, because the next step in this process of going to higher and higher higher level abstractions is to create interactive applications interactively. This is almost as old as all the layers we've seen before. I created Interface Builder back in 86, and there were some even earlier than that. And the idea is very natural, is I have all these visual objects, these buttons, these menus, these scroll bars. Why do I have to write code and measure pixels on my screen to lay them out? When I have a drawing tool that allows me to, you know, draw squares and rectangles and make WYSIWYG documents. So why don't we do a system where I can build my interface directly? Instead of having rectangles and circles in my tool palette, I will have buttons and scroll bars, and I will pick them, put them on my screen, and then I will only have to write the glue code that links those widgets to my application. But at least, if you look at the Java, typical Java Swing application, 60% of the code is on creating this bloody grid bag layout managers, initializing things, setting colors and sizes and things like this and fonts. So why don't we do this interactively? So in an interface builder, you have an editor where you create an interface. There's many typos in this. So you create your interface by drawing it, really, and then you create your functional core, which is the set of functions that are really the guts of your application. Then you create an interactive application that will load this description at runtime to build your tree of widgets, and then link it to your code here, so you have your final application. Now the problem with that, why is this in French? What happened there? I think this was not meant to be part of the...
Yeah.
What?
I was reading.
We are practicing our French.
Yeah, well, that's a hard one. So the problem with this, sorry, I'm... The problem with this is that you cannot distribute your application as a single executable file. It will have to come with this interface description file that it will have to load. If you have a big interface, it will be slow to interpret this, load it, execute it. So you also can have a mode where you compile your description of the interface that you build with your editor into a compiled interface. So you could turn them into these long things of Java Swing calls. Then you can link all of it together and have one interactive application that will not depend on this external file, and it will be more efficient because it won't have to interpret the widget tree structure, it will just be regular code. So,
the problem there is when you want to edit the interface, maybe you have to recompile.
Yeah, so, well, typically what you do is you do this while you're developing, and then when you want to do a release, you do that.
Okay.
If you have to do that every time you, well, it's slower. But historically, some systems were like this, some were like that, and some had both. So, now again, a number of things have changed. Computers are faster, and so the overhead of this approach is less significant than it used to be. So the system I'm going to demo is not, in fact, compiling the interface, but it's certainly an option. This is what I wanted to show. So I'm going to use Xcode and show you how to build a web browser without a single line of code.
I think Spring has an interface builder for NetBeans.
It's horrible.
Horrible, no?
It's terrible. I mean, I've tried for years. No, but really, it bugs me because we created this swing states toolkit that some of you are going to use in Anastasia's class. And one reason is that we wanted to have these ideas about describing interaction with state machines available to a wider audience. So we thought, you know, a lot of people program their interfaces with Java. But we also wanted to use it for teaching. But I was hoping that one day there will be an interface builder for Java that we could use in class. But I haven't found one, really, and I've tried. The least bad ones are the ones that are very expensive, so we can't afford them. But no, they're all... I mean, once you've seen that, you know, you will not want to use a Java interface builder, I think. So I'm going to create... a new project here. That's going to be a challenge on this small screen, but anyway, we're going to try. So I have to say I'm building a Cocoa application. That's a standard type of project. I need a name. It's going to be, I don't know, the next browser. Yeah. Okay. This exists déjà, ça. yet another browser, I'm being told. Okay, I have to say where do I want to do it. I don't want to Git repository. Let's be serious here. Okay, so here I have... so this is typically what the framework does for you, is that it created some things here, an app delegate with one line of code. I don't know what it does. I don't care. This is to start the application. The interesting thing is this. This is Interface Builder. a very small window for building anything. And so what I have here is the menu structure. So I could, as you can see, I could put the file menu after edit if I want to confuse my users. For each menu here, I can specify things on the right. I can change its label, I can change all sorts of things. We're not going to change the menu structure, but a number of these commands in here are actually already bound to some actions. So what I want to concentrate on is the main window of my application. I don't want this here. So I select the window object. Oh boy.
Michelle, yes. If you want, you can remove the columns. The upper right corner, the view, you can remove.
Here? But I don't want to remove anything.
Because you're fine.
Yeah, I know. But I'll do it this way. That's good enough. Okay, so for what do I need to build a browser? Yeah, so I need something to display the page. I need something to enter the URL and go back and forth. Okay? We'll do that. You think we can do it in 20 minutes?
Yeah.
Yeah. I have faith. So we have an object library here. And the object library gives me all the things I need. So here's a push button. Hey, that's cool, because I can put a push button. So I'm going to use it here. You saw that there was some predefined location that seemed appropriate. I don't have much space, so I'm going to save the space. If I double-click here, I can change the label here. So this is my previous button. I'm going to put another one for, guess what? Next. Then what do I need? Well, I need a text field. So do I have a text field here somewhere? Here's a text field. I'm going to put it here. I want it the whole width. So that's pretty good. Now the web view. Okay, so if I go into my library, I see something called WebKit here. Seems promising. And it has one thing called a web view. So I'm going to put it there. Have it use the whole available space. Well, okay, so let's see what that does. I'm going to run this. Build succeeded. Oh, crap.
You need to add the WebKit framework.
I know, but that was part of my plan. So something went wrong, and thank you. If I read the message here, it says that... where it says... I don't know. Somewhere it says that it tried to call a function that didn't exist that had to do with a web view. And the reason is that I didn't load the WebKit library. Now, this is just to illustrate something that annoys me every time I do this demo. Because if I put a web view in my interface, don't you think I will need the web view library? So, you know, it could have loaded it for me. So now I'm going to have to do this. I'm going to have to go back to the project here, and here I have the linked frameworks and libraries. So it has Cocoa, that's, you know, good thinking. I need a new one, so it gives me the whole list. Fully WebKit is at the end. I do WebKit. I add it. It's there. It's complaining, but I don't care. And I will try to run this again. It's still running. Well, you crashed it, so it's not really running, but okay. Do your thing. Build succeeded. And here is my beautiful interface, which, as you notice, works when I resize it. Because of the way I put things next to each other, it actually inferred some of the constraints. Now, it's not nice because it's overlapping here, but we can fix that. So I'm going to go back to the... where am I? To this thing here. Let's see if I can move this down a little bit. Yeah, something weird is going to happen. Okay, so I have this. Now what? Well, I need to write those bloody callbacks, right? Well, do I have to? Well, if I explore this with a right click, I see this web view has a number of outlets, and it has a number of actions. And if I run through this, I see something called go back. Well, that's cool, because I do want to go back at some point. So I can click here and drag something and link it to an object. Now, if I'm clever, I'm going to drag it to the previous object button. Here, I'm doing this to the next one. And then, I could have made a button for text larger, text smaller. That's good to know. I could have one for printing. But look, I have something called take string URL from. And so, if I link this to a text field, and it seems to be happy with that, it seems to work. So,
does that mean you will need to press return?
Maybe.
Maybe.
Okay, so, still working. Now, what happens if I do HTTP? Well, it works. What if I click on Fête de la Science? Well, it was not very exciting. Can I go to some other? Yeah. Well, if I do back, it goes back. If I go next, it goes next. Oh, next is not working. Yes, it does. And that's my web browser. You want something else? I'm sorry?
You should gray out the buttons.
Gray the buttons when there's no thing in the history? I could do that. So I'm not going to do it because we need to move on a little bit. But if I look at... So this is both a good and a terrible demo. I hope it's a good demo because, you know, it shows you that you can do a number of things without having to write code. It's a bad demo because it makes you think that you can do everything without writing code. And of course, it's not quite the case. So still, there's a number of things here that I can control directly from the interface builder. So one of those that I've shown is this way of linking some characteristics of those objects to other objects. In fact, it goes beyond here. I linked together interface elements like this text field to the web view to give it the URL. But what I have on the left here is objects that actually represent objects in my application. So if I have objects in my application, I can still describe their interface, their API, if you want, and have access to it from here. So I can link objects, visual objects, to other visual objects, but I can also link visual objects to objects in my application. And when I develop the application, I can modify the API, and it's reflected in the interface I see here. The other thing I can do, which is the next level, is the bindings. So the bindings is really Xcode's version of these active values I talked about. It's in fact way more sophisticated than that, to the point that I don't really know how to use it well. But it's very powerful in that it allows you to link objects together with bidirectional links and with transformation in between. So I could do something like verifying that the value is positive, or transforming a text into a number and things like this. So if you master this tool, you can do a lot of things just in Interface Builder. And in fact, something I don't have room to show here is that I can even link it to code. So I can have a display where I have the visual aspect on one side, my code on the other side. And if I want to, for example, define the code for a button, I can drag to my code, to either existing code, and it will link to it, or where there is no code, and it will create the template for the callback for me. So things are really very nicely integrated. The thing I don't understand is why there's no similar thing for other platforms. Because this is not new. Interface Builder was created when Steve Jobs was at Next. That was back in 95-ish. It's been on the Mac since 2000. So it's not like they haven't time to catch up and to steal ideas. But when you look at the Interface Builders you have for Java, they're really, either probably powerful, but extremely complex to use, not the level of direct linking that I've shown here. Okay, you have any questions on this? So to wrap up on this part, so this is an old version of Interface Builder. So in conclusion, there is no question that all these layers, from the graphic layer to the interface builders, reduce the development time, reduce the maintenance costs. They also facilitate compliance with style guides. You have many, on many platforms, or most platforms, you have Apple calls it the human interface guidelines that describe how things should look, how things should work, and also typical interaction patterns. The way to do things like default values, the way to do things like some typical dialog boxes. Now, putting them in a book is nice. Putting them into code that you reuse is even better. And so, just as you saw at the moment, when I was moving objects inside the window, it would snap to predefined position. which are the recommended spacing of objects on the screen, which, you know, don't come just out of pure graphic design, but it's also designed to minimize errors and to make things look consistent. So that's the advantages. Now, the limitations, and as I've pointed out before, is that the interaction style is based on widgets. If the widget you need is not in the toolbox, it's hard to create a new widget. You can do it, but it's hard. More often what you do is you use a blank widget that, and you program it in an ad hoc way for what you have to do. But still, it's making the assumption that interaction starts and ends inside the widget. And for a number of things, it's not the case. In fact, in Interface Builder itself, when I pull these lines to drag from one object to the next, there's no widget to do that. So if I wanted to build an interface that uses this, well, I can't reuse what they've done. I have to recreate it myself. The extensibility is limited in part because creating new widgets is hard. Sometimes they don't give you all the APIs to do it. And as I said, programming non-standard interactions is challenging. So there are underlying research issues behind this because we're still stuck in this widget model for we've been there for 20 years, is how do we go beyond the widget model? How can we actually have the equivalent of a toolkit of a framework or a builder where some of the techniques I've shown before could be things that I use directly and minimize the programming cost. And I think it's not just finding a better widget model, it's also defining better languages and environments. One thing we see today is that interaction is limited inside the widgets. Widgets are stuck inside applications. If you try to make interactions across applications, it's very hard. If you try to make an application that has multiple components, it's very hard. And the next step is, nowadays we are in a world where it's multiple devices. So you have your smartphone, you have a tablet, you have a laptop. You come to class, you know, there is something on the screen. There is no way for you today to take the slides off my machine while you're watching them. I have to go through hoops and things to put them on the website, so you have to think about downloading it the day before and printing it. This is absolutely silly. So we don't have an environment to create distributed interaction. I have to do it all by hand. And in fact, even though smartphones, for example, are a great success, you have, I was watching the Apple thing the other day, they have 700,000 apps in their app store, which is mind-boggling. But these apps, in general, they're isolated. And, you know, we have things like remote controllers and things that use cloud services. And so the only way to make two apps interact, it seems to be, is that you have to have a cloud service somewhere to link, I don't know, your photo stream to something on your laptop. Now this is a very limited way of looking at interaction. Is it time? And so again, I mean, I'm a researcher, so I'm always interested in, you know, things that are wrong and tend to look at the dark side of things, not the bright side. There's a lot you can do from learning these tools and doing things with these tools today. And I think they're vastly underused already because it's a tough learning curve. Using Xcode Interface Builder, it's not, you know, it's not something you do in a couple of days. And it's not something you learn at school either. You have to learn it by yourself. So, but you can do a lot of things with that. The thing is, what worries me is in any process where things become established, they get harder and harder to break. If we determined that it was much more efficient or would create less accidents if we drove on the left side of the road in France, you wouldn't be able to do it. And in computers, even though we have in theory a lot more flexibility, a lot of things are, you know, to change. And so, as someone who's teaching to master students who are going to go off, some into research, some into industry, my message is, you know, try to keep sort of breaking the rules and not making things the way everyone thinks they should be done, because we are wasting opportunities to create much more powerful interactions because we're stuck in models and protocols and ways of thinking. Okay? That was my message for the weekend. Now, I was going to start talking about conceptual modeling today. The fact that I didn't is going to make David's life harder for next TA because he was counting on it. So we'll have to see how we fix that. But next Wednesday, I've already put the slides for the last classes, so you can already download them. And I will put the content I showed today and yesterday online. Hopefully today and otherwise tomorrow. Okay?